Okay, hi everyone and welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. This week my guest is Lennon Cooper, who's the director of Cardboard Addicts and Golden Era and Title Town on the Adelaide 36ers, which are both available on YouTube at his YouTube account, NBAAussie.com. Definitely check them out, they're fantastic. That's where I first came across Lennon. I particularly like Title Town, but at the time of this recording, I hadn't seen Golden Era. I've now since gone back and watched it, and it's just as good, if not better. It's brilliant. So definitely check out those. Lennon's been doing stuff with Foxtel and ESPN Australia, even did the NBA Finals one year. We talk about pretty much everything from a little bit of NBL currently, a little bit, but mainly about the creation of sports content. So if you're out there and you're into sort of video or audio production in sports, this is definitely a great podcast for you. We talk about old 90s, you know, basketball DVDs or videos at that time, Michael Jordan's Playground and others, and how excited we are for The Last Dance, the Netflix series on the Bulls. Really good guy, Lennon. Really enjoyed talking with him. Where we pick up, we're talking about one of his videos on YouTube about the Australian Boomers in Rio.
That video, that one there, the Boomers one, is that one you just sort of thought, I've got some great footage and I'm going to put it together, or was that for something?
No, it wasn't for anything. It was just, I'm a Boomers fan and I've always like sort of archived their games and stuff like that. And as they were playing, by the time it got to like the second or third game and it was just such an exciting Olympics, I was like, oh, this would make a pretty thrilling story to put together. So, I just set about making like a mini movie. At the time, I was working for Fox Sports, so I just sort of had like a YouTube channel on the side where basically it was just my creative outlet, places where I could try new things that probably weren't refined enough to put on TV yet, but just mucking around with basketball clips and working out how I was going to do things before I'd use them, you know, on a national scale. That was just a good thing to have. So, yeah, the boom has happened right around the same time that I just started that. So I thought, I'll make something out of it.
Yeah, that's NBA Aussie. That's that one. You've now transitioned more to Flix Productions.
Yeah, so Flix Productions is a legit business, whereas NBA Aussie Films was just something that I did on the side in my spare time when I had time to kill. Like I said, it was more a creative outlet. Like I get ideas in my head and I'm like, how can I make that actually appear on screen the way that I want to? And NBA Aussie was just the way that I could, you know, do it through basketball because that's what I enjoy. And not just, you know, trash it at the end of it, at least have something to show for it.
I think with that one as well, I really liked it because how did you get some of those angles? Because they're not the standard press box type side to side. There's some real stuff. And I see that you've gone from 7 to NBC and a few others. How do you pull all that? And how do you remember where you've pulled it from? Or, you know, you see David Anderson make a shot and you're like, oh, I'm going to cover that from three different angles. How do you do something like that? Like, is it just a matter of compiling stuff?
Well, that's one of my unique styles. I hate the high angle wide shot. I try to tell every story from more of a closer to the action type shot, so it makes the viewer feel like they're more of a part of it. And in regards to the Rio stuff, there was a fair few feeds coming through. Obviously, we had Channel 7 showing some stuff, but there was also, you know, you could sign up to Olympic packages and when the ads were on, we were seeing as ads here in Australia were all the what we call ISO replays, which are all the tight camera angles. So when we're seeing ads, the stream is actually sending out replays of every field goal from that game. Yeah. So that's where most of those ISO shots come from. So
and you're clipping that as it goes, or you got the package at the very end and sift all through it again?
Yeah, I normally make it. I normally try to get it done within 24 hours of a game finishing.
Yeah.
But no, I'm not. Nah, I couldn't. I don't care enough to be up doing it late at night and that sort of stuff. So more just whenever I had free time. Like I said, I was at Fox, and just the way that my job worked at Fox is I'd have free time often in the middle of the day when things are sending or when you've done one story but you're waiting for another one to, like a press conference to start. There's just a lot of downtime, so I just sort of do it whenever I had free time.
Makes sense. I mean, the footage that I think, if you haven't seen, maybe you've seen it, if you haven't, you've got to check it out. You know Michael Jordan's famous shot over Craig Elo from the foul line?
Yeah.
Have you seen the odd footage or the unique footage that's come out now?
No, I haven't. Right, I've obviously only ever seen the one angle that we all remember. Well, this Gatorade ad.
I'm hoping to make a video about it, but if you can make a better one, by all means. It's a baseline angle. It's by like Chicago Sun Times or a small two-person local Chicago team. He makes the shot, and the angle, it's this weird, you know, when you're watching basketball not in a major stadium but more in like a rec center, and it's got a bit of a hollow feel to it, like because the crowd is just dead quiet. He hits this shot, and the guy goes, he hits it, and the reporter goes, go get out there, and they start running onto the court, and the Bulls are celebrating, and this reporter's grabbing Jordan. And he's grabbing him. He's like, Michael, you stuck it. You stuck it, Michael. And then he goes, Michael, you stuck it. And then Jordan just goes, like in a really tired, sort of dumbish sounding voice, he goes, yeah. It's the most raw you'll ever see, Michael. I'll send you the footage because I think everyone's got to see it. And then the national TV guys are like, we always ask the first question, and they're like shoving him off. It's this incredible footage.
I'm really excited, as probably every basketball fan is, but this Netflix series that's coming out of Jordan with all the unique footage. Like, I'm dying to see the stuff they've dug up. There's so many camera angles that we never see, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of that stuff in there. I can't wait.
And I mean, Bill Simmons talks about a lot. Like, I can only imagine the loneliness of being Jordan, 98. Mm. He can't go anywhere. And the thought of him in hotel rooms playing poker and whatever. I saw that. And it's going to be a huge part series.
I would not be surprised, and obviously I'm a biased basketball fan, but I mean, I would not be surprised if that's the highest rated thing Netflix ever has. Like, he's just, he just crossed so many markets that everyone is going to watch that.
I mean, the one that I thought was pretty brilliant is Made in America, the OJ one. Did you watch that?
Yes, I did. That was great. That was great. I mean, everything Netflix does is great.
I think that was films, but yeah, Netflix, if they can get that, that's such a big coup for them, because they're just now getting into sports. They had the Carter Effect. Did you see that one?
Mm, I did. Yeah.
Did you like that one? I'll just quickly say I didn't.
I did hear on your last podcast about that. I sort of agree with what you're saying. It's just, I just spent the whole time, I guess, similar to you, wanting more highlights, because that's what we love Vince for. Like, he's my all-time number one favorite player. But obviously their angle is something, you know, else. He changed basketball in Canada, and that's the storyline they were going for. Yeah. So I get that. I just wish there was more dunks.
I wish more dunks, and just more, like, because he was part of two really good series, one against Philadelphia and one against, I think, Milwaukee. Could have done that more there. Anyway, actually, I'll quickly sort of jump into questions I've got prepared here. So.
How
did you get into sports videography? Did you just come from a writing background, or you were more like tinkering around with films on your own?
It's kind of funny. Like, when I was at high school, I always wanted to be a journalist, like a sports journalist. I kind of always wanted to steal Boddy's job. He was my idol, and his wife just happened to be my PE teacher at school. So I spent a lot of time in year 10 and year 11 watching games and writing my own match reports and sending them to Boddy, and they'd come back with a lot of red pen through them. So I really liked that side of things. But then at the same time, in those formative years, I was really enjoying doing media studies as well. And obviously used a camera a lot at school. And there was one, kind of a long story, but there was one project in particular that I did in year 12, and my teacher was obviously impressed and sent it to a local film school here in Adelaide without me knowing, and then they got in contact with me and asked if, when I'd finished school, if I'd like to study there. Then went on and did that. It's a place called MAP, so Media Arts and Production Skills. So a lot of the people here, all the media people here from Adelaide, went through there. Mm-hmm. And I did that for a year, and like everyone, really struggled to ever get a foot in the door in the media, because everyone wants that sort of job. But I happened to be I was the manager at a video store, and one of my customers...
Sorry to interrupt. What video? Blockbuster or a small chain?
Video Easy.
I've done a bit of... I remember video stores. I worked at one myself. Yeah. A couple, actually. Sorry, you were saying.
Yeah, yeah, that's all right. I'm older than you think. So I was managing a video store, and one of my customers was the sports producer at Channel 10. And I remember I just used to always just give him his movies for free and just say, if a job ever comes up, let me know. You know, gotcha. I studied media and, you know, I really want to have a go and, you know, that sort of stuff. And I actually remember the very last time I rented him a film, I remember as he walked out the door, I remember thinking, I've got to stop giving this guy free movies. Like, obviously he doesn't know me from a bar of soap, except for the guy who gives him movies. Why would he ever recommend me? And lo and behold, the next day, I got a phone call from the head of production at Channel 10, who'd said he highly recommends me and they wanted to chat. Oh, I went in there and got the job as a camera assistant. Mm-hmm. And then over the years went from camera assistant to editor to cameraman, editor, and then was at Channel 10 for about 2-3 years. And even though I was mainly in news, I always used to come in and sort of try and put dibs on any of the Sports Tonight stories that were going that day. Cool. And then when the Fox Sports Bureau was starting up here in Adelaide, somehow they heard about me and poached me from 10. And then I was here at the Fox Sports Bureau for about 10 or 11 years, covering all sorts of things here and overseas. And then just in the last 2 years, started my own production company. We're now making my own stuff, which tends to be largely focused on sports, not by choice, just by that's my main interest and that's where a lot of my contacts lie.
Right. And when you were, the film you made in high school, was that a sports-related thing or just a film in
general? Oh, my God. It was. This is so pathetic. It was a remake of one of the scenes from Scream, and my best friend played all the characters in the scene. Oh, so
He was Drew Barrymore. I'm guessing Drew Barrymore.
No, okay. No. It was one of the scenes where someone gets killed in the shower, I think, from memory. And he played the girl getting killed, and he played the killer, and he played one of the witnesses. And, oh, my God.
Was there any attempt to disguise him? Or that
obviously
was the
showed something. What's that, sorry?
Was there any attempt to disguise him, or was that, or him or her, or was that the humor that it was?
He looked as much like a girl as, I guess, Chris Lilly does when he plays Jermaine and stuff like that. It was pretty obvious.
All right.
But I think that was kind of the charm of it all.
Yeah, that's fine. And then Maps, you were saying, like, so there you studied just broadly everything from editing to camera.
Yeah, that's a very, very broad course. So you can sort of specialise in certain things, which I specialised in directing and camera. But in your time there, you touch base on every part of filmmaking.
Right. It's from sort of news stuff all the way through to just sort of feature films and TV, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's less news gathering and more. Yeah, it's more like creating TV show type things and movie type skill sets.
Cool. We were talking before about like how eager we are for the Jordan thing. What's that going to be called? The Last Dance. Are there any sports or basketball ones in the past that you thought like, oh, that's amazing in the past that you really loved?
I mean, I like pretty much every 30 for 30 basketball story they've ever put out there.
I mean, I think for me, obviously the Michigan one's really good. Once We're Brothers is really good. I think there was one on a guy who played for Boston. It was, you know, sort of that story of went to the NBA and got caught up in drugs. But do you have one that you especially like?
Yeah. I think what I look for in sports stories is less about the sport and more about the human side of it. So I think from that angle, my favourite 30 for 30 is actually not a basketball one. It's Catching Hell with the guy who caught the ball at the Cubs game.
Yeah,
that one's incredible. Like that guy's entire life was just ruined by one crazy moment. Like, yeah, that's one that, yeah, I could watch 1,000 times.
And what about stuff like those classic sort of 90s NBA movies like Michael Jordan's Playground, Larry Bird? Did you have a particular affinity for those?
Yeah, all of those. They were kind of the catalyst for why I decided to make Golden Era in the first place is I just... those things had been, at that time, those things had been lacking for a good decade. And, you know, I think anyone of my era watched Michael Jordan's, you know, playground and airtime enough times that, you know, like the VHSs were barely watchable by the time you were done with them. Like, I know I could watch it 3-4 times in a day and then go outside and try to replicate the moves. And we just had not ever, we just stopped doing them for some reason at some point in time.
Why do you suppose that is? Because I've wondered that myself.
I don't know if it, I don't know if it's the reason, but I do notice that it coincides with the invention of the DVD. So I don't know if that has anything to do with it in terms of the economic benefits of how hard something like that is to put together versus how much money they can make. But it did really seem to coincide with the evolution of DVDs. I don't know if that's it.
Well, I think I've got a theory again. I don't know for sure, but I think with the immediacy of, like, because with DVDs also came the internet, and with that immediacy, I think like long form content, you know, because you can watch Come Fly With Me in the season, out of the season, 10 years later, 20 years later, it doesn't matter. When the content really became time critical is when you saw that sort of stuff drop off, and I think wrongly so. I don't know, because I watch stuff like, I don't know if you ever watched like NBA Timeout, or what was that used to, what it used to be called?
NBA Action.
You watch it now and it just doesn't seem to hold up as much. And I'm sure it's the same as I remember it. Or, I don't know. I've never quite been able to put my finger on it, much like yourself.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think times just change, and the way that we consume media changes, and the way that we expect from a show changes. I mean, you know, we all sort of, as NBL fans, we all sort of hang for like an NBA Action equivalent for the NBL, but I think you're right. I think that format's gone. I don't think you can hold people's attention for 30 minutes showing, you know, highlights of the week's games and, you know, maybe one feature in a top 10, which is essentially all NBA Action was. But we just, our attention spans are just not the same as they used to be, I reckon.
It'd be a very interesting little study to take, say, because my favourite was Michael Jordan, Come Fly With Me. Take Come Fly With Me, pop that into a, even the DVD copy, whatever. Pop that into a classroom now and see how kids respond to it. I'd be very surprised if they didn't respond in the same way of kids of sort of the 90s did when I first watched it. I'd like to see, actually. That might be a fun little thing.
Yeah, I mean, I put Space Jam on the weekend for my seven-year-old son, and he was glued. And that actually surprised me because he doesn't know Looney Tunes. He had no idea who Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd and all those guys.
Probably not.
Yeah. He's got a 10-foot picture of Michael Jordan on his bedroom wall. Thanks to Dad. But he knows who he is. But he just resonated with my Michael Jordan as the you know, as the hero and the superstar basketball player. But I kind of put it on expecting him not to like it, but he did. I mean, he's Michael Jordan. Who doesn't like him?
Here's a quick question: what about movies that are basketball related but non like game, like say He Got Game or Above the Rim? Have you got a favourite one of those?
Above the Rim holds a soft spot in my heart, probably because I watched it 1,000 times as a kid.
Yeah.
He Got Game's great because I just love how much Denzel looks like Dr. J. It's ridiculous.
That's true.
And Ray Allen's got some fair acting chops. He's not bad in some of those scenes. Mm. So they're probably two that I like. I used to like Rebound, which is an early Don Shardell movie, which is the true story of El Manigault.
The Kareem's favourite player.
Yeah, that's a good, you know, fall from grace type story. I like all those 90s basketball movies. You know, I even like The Air Up There with Kevin Bacon and the Jimmy Dolan Shake and Bake. Like,
yeah,
you know, I think we all remember just about all of them. They all resonate in a different way.
Yeah, the one we've left off the list is, which is my favorite. I think White Men Can't Jump, I think, is probably
nothing compares to that.
I mean, I think that, I'd love to see if people watch that now, having never seen it, and still think that's as good. I mean, I know it's Stanley Kubrick's, one of his favorite films.
I find it hard to watch White Men Can't Jump now that I've since found out that Wesley Snipes was a terrible basketballer, so they had to shoot everything in high speed so that in slow motion it didn't look as bad. And now if you, sorry for anyone that I've just ruined it for, but if you watch it now and you realise that what you're watching is slow motion, you kind of realise how Uncle Wesley Snipes was, and it's hard to watch now.
And the travels. Apparently he just travelled the whole time. I think. Have you read that article on what would have been Grantland, I guess, about Why We Can't Jump? I think that was...
Yeah.
About that. But, I mean, the one I liked about... Like, Marquis Johnson is in that. Like, he's a former NBA guy. And I think he's an assistant coach.
Yeah. Is that Raymond?
Raymond, that's right.
And he, he's the best character.
Like, that's crazy because he's a former NBA guy and future analyst, because I remember he did a few like drafts in the sort of late 90s, early 2000s. And he's and he's there playing like a violent, gun-toting character. you wouldn't see that so much anymore. A lot of guys would be like, oh, no, I can't play that character. And he went for it. And I thought he was just an actor.
Yeah.
And I looked him up. I was like,
same. I'm the same as you. I didn't find that out. Obviously, living in Australia, we didn't see a lot of those games. So I didn't find that out until 10 years later either. Same. But
and the thing is,
he's one of the standout characters.
Looked on the credits, and apparently Gary Payton is in White Men Can't Jump. Now, I have watched White Men Can't Jump from beginning
really?
To back to front. He's credited. It's in the IMDb little trivia bits. Gary Payton.
Wow.
I've scaled the whole thing. I'm going to put a line through it. I don't think it's true.
I have not spotted him, but now I'm going to keep an eye out. That's for sure.
Indeed. And I've actually got a VHS copy of it sitting just on my shelf over there. And at the start, it's the Australian VHS copy that's an ex-rental, because, as I said, I worked at a store, and on my way out the door, I took a couple of mementos. And there's a little thing where Steve Carfino's at the start of it, and he's like, hey, guys, come to the NBA. I can't remember what he says, but he's...
Oh, my God.
Anyway, let's talk about Title Town, because I obviously was just flipping through the net, looking at a whole bunch of stuff, and found Title Town, which is on YouTube in its entirety. If you're an NBL fan, you got to watch it. Let's talk about that. So how did you get that made? Was that something that you just thought, I've got this footage, I want to make it? Or did you approach the Sixers, or did they approach you? How did that work?
So it all sort of started with Golden Era. I'm not sure if you've seen Golden Era, but that's the first of that. So Title Town's actually a sequel. But essentially, what happened is, I was a big Sixers fan. I was pretty tight with most of the players and stuff down there, and stuff through my job at Fox Sports. Used to spend a lot of time down there, and we'd just hear like tons of stories from some of the old fellas about, you know, their feats back in the day. And I'm sort of just outside of that golden era time. Like, I never really got to see your Al Greens and your Mark Davises in their prime. And I'd hear these stories, and I kind of was always like, you know, there's a bit of juice on top of this story. That can't be right. Like, you never really quite believed every word of what they were saying. Mm-hmm. And I ended up coming across like a couple of old games from the 80s. It was probably 85, 86, one of those invincible seasons. And I remember watching it, and I think it was actually the Darryl Pierce 48-point game against Newcastle. And my eyes were just open. I was like, oh, my God, all these stories are true. They're not embellished in any way. If anything, they've sort of undone them in what they've told me. And I kind of felt like a responsibility, if nothing else, than to get these stories out there and not necessarily prove that they're real, but have like a firm documentation of these things that I felt like should have already been done. So for me, it was kind of like when I realized all these feats really happened and that there was no way for the average person to witness them, and I sort of felt like that's not fair to them, to their family. Like, you know, they tell their kids how great they were and they kind of don't have any real proof. So for me, it was more of a project for the players themselves, something they can look back on when they're 50, 60 years old. And they can be like, check out all this stuff we did, show the grandkids and that sort of stuff. So from there, it was just a very loose idea of let's make documentaries, break them into decades, and see what we can do from there. And at the time, Ben Fitzsimmons was the GM of the 36ers, who was also a massive Sixers fan before that. So that was a great person to take this idea to, because he didn't hesitate in greenlighting it like immediately. He was all for it, and couldn't have been more supportive from day one. And eventually, that's essentially where the idea started from. Is it was, I guess, it was more of a, I felt the players were hard done by, that they didn't really have a historical record on film of the things that they've done.
Because the NBL, like, you know, there's a fair bit of stuff out now with the NBL app, which is, I think, really great. You get a couple of classic games. But a lot of the history, other than Golden Era, Title Town, and a few sort of seemingly just only Perth and Adelaide documentaries, yours and a couple in Perth, there's not really... It's pretty much an unspoken history, you know? Obviously, you've got articles from Body and others, but if you go searching YouTube, you know, you find a fair bit of stuff, but nothing like Golden Era and Title Town. Just, you got the whole 70s, 80s in Golden Era, which I'm halfway through, and then Title Town, obviously, late 80s through to sort of 2000. You know, it's there. You know, it's, you got it. There's your sort of almost like video encyclopedia or retrospective, you know?
And I think it's important to have, because you kind of, like, it's hard to separate fact from fiction, you know, without those things. You know, there's a lot of things that, you know, are hard to believe that may have really happened, or things that, you know, have been embellished over the years that aren't quite the truth. So, yeah, I don't think that's ever going to happen again, because we have such this extensive, you know, library, and the NBL is doing such a good job of keeping all the games and stuff now. But, yeah, those 80s and 90s period, it just wasn't really like that.
Yeah, a lot of it was unspoken, and you know, that's why I think Title Town's so good. So, going on from that, so when you got the idea, so let's say everyone's like, it was Fitzsimmons, what was his first name, sorry?
Ben Fitzsimmons, yeah.
Ben Fitzsimmons, so he goes, yep, great idea, let's go for it. Do you then, like, write a script, or are you just watching game tape? How do you kind of get your story for that?
Well, first thing I did was hit up Statman at the NBL, who is probably the greatest statistician of any sports, and I hit him up and basically was like, what have you got for me on the Sixers? This is my idea. And he sent me an Excel spreadsheet of every scoreline of every game that they'd ever played. So that was a very good starting point. I was basically going through every year and going win, win, loss, win, loss, 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 win, win, win. And then I would look at that season and go, oh, okay, here we go. They started with an 8-game winning streak. They finally went down to X team, but then they backed that up with a 50-point win. And you could sort of see the story of that season map out with just a bunch of the W's and L's on a piece of paper. You could sort of see how that season evolved.
Sure.
Yeah, and then I started the mammoth task of trying to acquire as many games and highlights as I could. So the first place I went was Guy James, who is probably the best NBL director of all time, who has been doing it for probably 30 or more years. He, as a Sixers fan and someone who also works at Channel 9 and has access to those games, had compiled like a insane archive of every news story since 1983 that the 36ers have ever done on Channel 9.
Just Sixers or NBL?
Just Sixers. So he's Adelaide guy.
He's Adelaide guy.
So he's based here in Adelaide, and he only directs Adelaide-based games because his primary job is he's the director of Channel 9 News. So
what compelled him to do that? Just because he's a fan? Or because he thought there was some way this might come back in the...
I mean, yeah, it's a bit of both. He's a mega fan, and he also knows that this stuff might be handy to bring up later on. Like, as a director, I know, you know, there's a few times this season where, you know, he might have a Adelaide versus Cairns game, and he'll go, oh, the last Cairns game was won on a buzzer beater. Actually, 7 games in the past have been won on a buzzer beater, and he'll be able to go and dig out all 7 of those game winners because of the extensive archives that he's, you know, spent his entire career collating. And it's
Is that a physical archive of tapes, or it's digitized?
Yeah, so I imagine massive tapes, like tapes three times the size of a VHS.
A Betamax.
The old Betamax SPs, SXs. And he has about 200 of them. And just about 3 or 4 years ago, Channel 9 moved locations from their old historical site to a much smaller location in the city. And I was honoured that Guy reached out to me and offered for me to look after the whole collection. So they're sitting in my house right now. And from time to time, when he needs highlights, he'll hit me up and I'll dig out a tape, but yeah, I keep them in my house now so that they're in proper temperature controlled conditions. And so he just had everything up to the point of where I was at that time. And then since then, I've recorded every NBL game in full HD for the last 10 years, and I have all of those on Blu-ray. So,
good man. And that's the beautiful thing about the NBL, I think, only until the last, I'm going to go and say 3-4 years, maybe a bit longer, but it is literally a garage league. There are guys out there who have just been like a mega fan. There's a German word, Liebenkünstler, which means you just do things like your life is your art. Like a guy would have taped these things, not because he thought there was a great reward in it. He just did it because he felt like doing it. And what the NBL, like, it's and now that stuff is just starting to come to the surface with the app and people starting to go back.
Yeah.
And it's a really, really sort of charming little story.
People like Guy and even Statman Mark Slocum, like, them two just epitomize that. Like, both of them have just accumulated the incredible history of this league and didn't do it for any reason other than they just wanted to collect it. I know that Statman was collecting his stats for, 10 to 15 years for nothing. Like, was not an employee by the NBL or anything. He just was a basketball fan and a statistical fan. And I'm glad that, after all those years, the NBL picked him up in an official capacity. So he doesn't do it right now, but he did it for the first couple of years of the new ownership. And, that's great because people like that can get lost to the game because most of these things that were done for the NBL were done for nothing more than passion, and a lot of time it goes unnoticed. So yeah,
I mean, you might remember a 30 for 30 called Rotisserie Baseball about the guys.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Do you get the same vibe from the NBL? Guys just like, we like baseball. We like, doing stats and creating our own team. Let's just create this. It's the same thing with, Statman and Guy James by the sound of it.
Yeah, exactly. It is exactly like that.
So then my next question with Titletown is, you got a couple of interviews with the likes of Botty and Mark Davis and a whole bunch of guys like that. When you're asking them questions, have you've got your story in mind, or you just kind of put the camera on and let them go? What was your process with them?
As a basketball fan, you could go in there and you could sit down with each person for 6 hours if you don't know where you're going. So I would sort of start with, maybe 10 points that I'm considering touching on during each season. And I would sit down with the player, and they might have only played for 5 out of that 10 years, or, 7 out of that 10 years. And we'll discuss the points that I'm thinking about bringing up. And then later on, when it gets back to the edit and I'm building a story, I decide which ones of those are worth talking about and which ones just get chucked in the can.
Yeah.
And I sort of build the story that way because, you can only tell so much by looking at scores and talking to Body and reading newspapers, which is pretty much was my prep before. But a lot of the time, the best stuff is the stuff you're not expecting to be good. So you'll sit down and, the last thing on your list that you were considering talking about in a certain season turns out to be the best part of that season. And that then goes to the top of your list when you talk to the next person who played in that year, if that makes sense.
And did you just approach them directly? Because now, players, you've got to sort of go through the media and things. But with those guys, did you just approach them?
Like I said, I've always had a very good relationship with the 36ers. They've always been very welcoming to me. Past players in particular at that time, my Basel team was entirely ex-36ers players except for me. So I had pretty good access to most guys, especially the Titletown guys. My social team was me and Kevin Brooks and Paul Bauer and Martin Catalini, Rupert Sapwell, like pretty much all the guys from
that makes it easy,
championship year. So getting them was easy. People like Marzi I've known forever. Phil Smythe, it helps that, I'd been at Fox Sports for a good 5 years by then. So pretty much everyone that I'd interviewed for Golden Era or Titletown, I'd interviewed them a dozen times before for TV. So most of these guys, I had their phone number and they were more than happy to do it.
And they were such good on-camera talent. Do you think that's just the nature of their personalities, or were they so excited to be questioned and put on camera? Were they excited about the
I think they're all great. I think they're all great personalities. There weren't a lot of egos in those guys, and I think that's probably a lot of the reason why they were so successful, because they were able to share the ball around and stuff like that. They're all just, you know, it's team sport mentality. They're all pretty lighthearted and into help each other. So, you know, and I spoke a lot to Boddy before, like in the prep as well. And I knew the guys that, you know, I had to get. Like, he was adamant that I had to get Daryl Pierce, someone who I'd never met or spoken to. And Boddy just could not speak highly enough of his humour and his character as a person. And he was like, you can't make it without Iceman. So, getting him to come over to Adelaide and sort that out was like imperative. And then once I sat down with Daryl, I remember calling Boddy afterwards and just being like, this guy is so good. Like, he's just the best. His humour is amazing. And between him and Al Green, who is just, I think Al Green's the best talent in Australia when you're talking about basketball, because
Cal Bruton is a
second. Well, you know, they're best mates, so that's not surprising. Yeah. But they come from that old school American style where they just don't shit talk. They don't. Yeah, basically, Australians, it's in our nature to talk down our successes, to try and be perceived as humble and that sort of stuff. Americans are not like that. Americans are like boxers. They're like, you know, they're like Mike Tyson. I'm the best. I'm going to smash this guy. I'm going to beat this guy. And both Cal and Al are, they're like that. And so to put someone like Al at the forefront of Golden Era was a no-brainer, because I might have had six guys who I asked the same question to, and were like, yeah, we were pretty good that year. We had a couple of good wins in that Australian way. And then Al would be like, man, we were unbeatable. Like, no one would ever, like, no one would come near us. We were smashing teams. Like, and it's just like, you need that humour, that honesty, you need that in that to really drill home how great this team was. And if someone like Al wasn't there to say it, it's hard to get others to say it.
Well, I think Boddy, he's got a favourite moment of the thing where you're interviewing Pierce and he goes, oh, you know, Al Green, you know, he was from another part of Adelaide and we amalgamated. You know, I kind of liked him, kind of didn't. Nothing was really set. He's tiptoeing around it. And then you immediately cut to Al Green, who goes, I hated him.
Yeah, and that's
did
that
you know when you gave that response,
well,
you were like, bang, I know the cut.
Oh my God, I pissed myself laughing so hard when he said it, because I'd already done Al, and as soon as he said it, I knew in my head how that was going to go together, and I was just like, thank God one of you two is honest, because I have no doubt that Daryl hated him too, but he's Australian and he doesn't want to say that, and Al just doesn't care. So, you know, Al wasn't saying I hate him now, he was saying I hate him then, so that's fine.
Okay, yeah, that's the distinction. Did you make them back-to-back or at the same time, Golden Era and Tiletown?
I made them back-to-back, so I made Golden Era first, and like I said, Ben Fitzsimmons couldn't have handled that situation better. He organised a big premiere at the cinemas here, and we sold out the tickets in like a couple of hours, and that was awesome. We had all the old 80s players flew over to come watch it, and that was incredible. That was really
because that was the goal of the whole thing, you know, to be like, you know, guys, like, we've got a visual and written record now, you know.
Yeah. So that was amazing. I mean, hopefully their families, you know, got out of that what I was hoping, you know, because like I said, for me, it was all about them having this historical record of what they did, and hopefully, you know, their families were there and had a whole new respect for, you know, what they'd done.
Yeah. And so you made Golden Era first. Was there always in mind that you'd make Tiletown, or because Golden Era went so well, you're like, you know what, let's double down?
Yeah, well, it was originally going to be like a three-part documentary, but then ownership and management changed at the 36ers. Mm-hmm. And things just became really difficult, I guess is the easy way to put it. Once Ben Fitzsimmons was not there anymore, it was... I mean, this is just something that I just did for myself. I did for myself. and for the club. I had nothing to gain from it. I was doing it entirely in my free time on weekends.
I was about to ask, did you get any sort of, you got help, did you get any help financially or just help with like time?
No. It was just, I just made them all because I thought they should be there. Yeah. And when the DVD sold, I got a small cut of that. But I mean, if you work out my hourly rate, it was like 10 cents an hour. But when it got to the new management and we started, and I started the process of Titletown and the new management came in, it was very businesslike and just made me really uncomfortable because that's not what I was there for. I was not there to do this, you know, to be treated like a business, because to me at the time I was just, yeah, I was a fan with a unique skill set that could help them. That's all I ever saw myself as.
Sure.
But I was sort of treated more like you're a business and, you know, we're doing this business deal together. And so once Titletown wrapped, I was like, I'm just going to sit this one out for a while, and didn't go forth with any plans that I had in my mind for doing a third. And the more that I thought about the third, the tougher that storyline,
yeah, because it's
just
not
became to tell in my head. You know, there's an amazing story arc in Titletown. I mean, the story arc in Golden Era, it's you build a team, they fail. This, you know, like Rocky, they lose the first year, and then in '86 they come back, they storm it, they win the whole thing, and slowly it goes down. Mm-hmm. Titletown has that story arc. They make a grand final early, but they lose. They spend years rebuilding. And then they win back-to-back championships, yeah, and that's your finish line. That's an amazing story arc.
Yeah.
You go to the next, and it's just 10 years of failure,
yeah,
and, like, coaches off the... Like, there's the 2002 championship, but then it's just, mm-hmm, you know, 10, 12, 14 years of failure and coach turnovers, players leaving, and it's hard to sort of pump that up. So
yeah,
I kind of got in my mind it'll take another championship before...
That,
I can work out how that story goes,
right,
because you don't want to leave that story on a low.
Understood. Oh, well, fingers crossed.
A couple of years ago.
Yeah, I know.
A couple of years ago in game five, I was like, here we go, now we can do it. But,
what would you have called it?
I mean, game five. Oh, God. I don't know. It would be dependent on that last championship, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah, no, because I just watched him, and I watched half of Golden Era. I watched Titletown first because I didn't see Golden Era; it just didn't come up on the YouTube.
Yeah,
I thought it was brilliant. So yeah, I just want to say really well done on that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Flix Productions. So you then sort of you realize you're making Titletown, and people are patting you on the back for it, and it's great stuff. You make that decision to go into sort of Flix, or things are just going well and it happens organically. How does starting your own sports or
a couple of things happened. There were some changes happening at Fox, and there was some, like, they were offering packages for people who may want to leave and go do other things.
Okay.
And the time was sort of right for me to go off and branch out and try to make my own sort of stuff. So I took that opportunity and did that. And then one of the first things I made when I came out from Fox was the Terence Ferguson documentary, Living Fearless, which I did for ESPN.
Yep.
So that
was one of the here or in America.
That was Australia.
Australia.
Yeah, ESPN Australia and America are pretty separate. They sort of don't communicate that much. I did the Terence Ferguson thing. We sort of briefly touched on his time here in Australia, just in the last probably 12 months was when I got the idea for Cardboard Addicts and went down. That path, and that premiered a couple of weeks ago to great success, which has been good.
Definitely. I haven't seen it yet because I don't have pay TV, but I'm going to definitely I'll source it somewhere. Going back to what we were saying about how sort of management changes and things, could you see yourself working with the NBL now? Like, do you think that change at Adelaide was a change just there, or do you feel it's kind of swept through sports and even maybe media in general, or is that fair to say?
Yeah, I'd love to work with the NBL, but I think they sort of they tend to keep things internal. When management first changed over, I spoke briefly with their social guy Mike there. He was great, and we talked about doing some stuff, but it didn't really eventuate into anything. But I'd love to I'd love to get on board and make some long form stuff for them, but they tend to, I don't know what it is, but I don't know when you do things for the NBL, they, I don't know what it is, they look at you a bit differently. Rather that you want them to look at you and go, oh, that's great what you've been doing, helping to promote our league, and you know, thanks, but nothing like that ever happens. So, for whatever reason.
Peculiar. Let's talk about Cardboard Addicts. So, you're a collector yourself, and that's how the story kind of got born?
Yeah. So, I got into collecting probably 7 or 8 years ago, right before my son was going to be born. I knew that we were going to name him Kobe after Kobe Bryant, and I happened to stumble into a card shop and hadn't collected since I was, you know, 20 years since I was a kid, and bought a Kobe Bryant card because I thought, oh, this would be cool to give my kid one day, and it very quickly got out of control, and now I'm one of those sad adults who collects three-inch pieces of cardboard. But it's a fun hobby, and there's worse things you could be doing, and the community's great, and I just thought this would make a good story.
Well, I remember there used to be a card shop you used to go to called Al's Card Shop, and I find a lot of card shops do have that sort of John's Card Shop or Barry's Card Shop. And I remember walking in there. I never did think I'd make a TV show about it, you know, or anything like that. But I thought this is unique. I'm in a unique space right now. The way it's laid out, the lingo, the sort of, you go into a card shop, you don't get a hello, or you don't get anything until you're maybe eighth time through the door. It's like the stonecutters from The Simpsons. You got to have a handshake. You got to know a stonecutter to be a stonecutter and collect cards.
Yeah.
Do you collect them fanatically? Like you're in the books trying to find out what's worth the most money, or do you just like the aesthetic?
Yeah. I'm pretty pathetic about that. I'm the world's biggest Ingalls collector, basically, and so I focus most of my attention on Joe Ingalls cards, which are now just becoming ridiculous now that he's hitting his stride in the NBA. But I have databases of every single card that I have and still need. So it's pretty pathetic, but it's fun.
With your database of like you've obviously got your videos yourself. How do you keep all that? Like, Body was telling me, you have a really good catalog and a good way of categorizing it. Is there something special to your collection? The way you keep it?
Are you talking about games and stuff?
Yeah, games. And
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah. So, there's nothing super technical about it, other than obviously everything's kept chronologically. Everything is on DVD from 1979 up until probably about 2010-11 when HD sort of changed over. So I have everything in, you know, those big DVD folders, and they're all chronological, and I have them all like marked in an Excel spreadsheet with any keynotes that might happen. But I also actually just print on the disc if there's anything that I may later think is of note. So when I'm flicking through, I might go, I need a whole bunch of highlights from 2002. And while I'm flicking through them, there might be a note on one that says, Willie Farley scores 45 points. And I'll be like, yep, that's worth getting out. Or it might say, Sixers lose on the buzzer, Sixers win on the buzzer. Damon Lowry's free throws, you know, game, stuff like that. So that when I'm just flicking through a folder, normally it just stands out to me if there's anything worth looking at.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, I because, you know, I got a bit of stuff myself, and I must admit my category's a mess. I try to keep it organized, but it just never quite works out that way. Even when I've got it digitized, you just one slip up, you know, you put in one bit of video that you don't label or label improperly or poorly, and it can sort of, it's like a little
I'm very OCD like that. Like I've already recorded and burnt all of this year's NBL games to Blu-ray, but I'm yet to categorize them for that reason, because I'm so OCD that it will take me hours. Like I'm not the type of person who can just chuck them in a folder and then just get back to them when I need. I want them in a very specific order with notes on them and everything, so that when I do need them in 20 years' time, I'm not fussing about trying to find it.
Awesome. The one game I'm really chasing, because I'm looking to do, you know, try my hand at making a little video myself, the elimination game when Crocs Cats, where it really hits the 10 threes, Corey Homicide Williams goes crazy. Do you think you'd have that?
Probably not. If it doesn't have sixes in it, I probably don't have it. Otherwise, I'd have no room in my house for games. So I have all the grand final series and every game of sixes I've ever played. Okay. But besides that, there's just no room. I reckon your best chance for finding things is players from that time. They tend to have good stashes. I know that, you know, a lot of my stuff, like, came from, like, well, Scott Ninnis's dad had an incredible collection. Like, he was the ultimate proud father, and just had, when I said to Scotty, oh, you wouldn't happen to have any games, like, yeah, my dad recorded everything, and then got boxes and boxes and boxes of VHS tapes, perfectly labeled dates, teams they played, score lines, everything written on the VHS sticker, and it was incredible. And I mean, he must have given me 200, 300 games to convert, which was awesome. And then in the 90s, Steve Breeny, who was the assistant coach through that glory period, he, as a technical coach, just had, like, every game. So he even had all the games that weren't televised, so they were recorded internally on, like, a handycam. So,
wow, or something like that.
Yeah, and he had all of those, and they were all just in at the powerhouse, locked in a back room. And I just went in there one day and raided the whole thing and just got everything. So if you're looking for a game, I recommend players and their families. There's a lot of proud parents out there that would have recorded that game you're looking for.
Hadn't thought of that. That makes total sense. I absolutely will.
The other thing may be that it may not have been televised. You never know.
I remember going to the game, because the reason why I wanted, I'm at that game, and Steve Carvino is doing a piece to camera at the end, and I'm a big wrestling fan, so I'm in the background, I'm doing like that, you know, the DX sucker thing. I'm a bit embarrassed about it now, but I'm like, you know what, whatever. So I want to tell this story about, you know, me personally there, and I've got a little bit of game footage that I've captured on my, like, a digital camera or something like that. So I'd like to interweave the two, and obviously it's a great game, really went absolutely nuts. And then there's I used to just hang around the stadium and hung around. So there's, like, photos of me. I'm, like, running on the court and security's after me. And I'm in the car park and I'm standing next to John Ridley. So maybe tying something like that could be fun. And he's, like, got his shoes off and he's, you know, and anyway. So that's the hope. But I'll get a hold of it. Don't you worry. Have you done the
There is a guy in Perth who has just about every Wildcats game there is. So if I can find his email, I'll hook you up. But I know that he was doing essentially what I was doing for Perth. Like, he was archiving every game he could. So I'll get you his details. Or if he's listening to this, just hit Joseph up.
Okay. I'd appreciate it. That's very kind. Have you done the NBA stuff? I saw on your
So in 2015, I went over and covered the entire final series, which was the first Cavs versus Golden State series, the one that Golden State won. So that was incredible.
What's just, that like?
It's funny when you're there, you don't think much of it. Like, obviously, the first time that you talk to LeBron and stuff, it's a bit like, oh my God, that's LeBron. But after about the second or third time, you kind of take it for granted. You're not really thinking much of it. It feels like, you know, for me, like, after talking to him a couple of times, it just feels like talking to Taylor Walker or Eddie Betts, like, who, you know, we see every day in the job back here. But it's when you come home and all of that stuff has died down and your focus is no longer on getting the job done, because the whole time you're there, that's all you're thinking. You're thinking in little bursts, like, I've got to get this storyline up within the next 2 hours. And then that happens, and then you're like, okay, now we have to get this done. We've only got 3 hours to do it. And so you're always concentrating on those little deadlines and stuff, but it's when you come back and it's 2, 3, 4 weeks later and you get back into the swing of doing the normal stuff and you start going, oh my God, 3 weeks ago I was shooting on the same court as Steph Curry and stuff like that. That's when you're like, wow, that's when it sort of sinks in. So I wouldn't say I took it for granted, but you're so focused on getting the job done that it's hard to absorb that while you're there. But it, I mean, it's without doubt the highlight of my career.
Oh, yeah. And when you're there, like, obviously you've done NBL stuff. What's the difference, just sort of player-wise? Like, there obviously is an extended vibe, but did you get anything particularly unique about the situation?
Oh, man, the way they deal with the media is just incredible. Like, I always compare it to AFL, because obviously being at Fox Sports, I deal with AFL, I have dealt with AFL players every day in AFL clubs, and they're very guarded and sheltered, and they'll give you whoever they want to talk. It's never the person that you want to talk to. Okay. They'll only say the things that they want to say. America is totally different. Everyone is, all the media are just welcome in. So, like, essentially, we'll just go through one finals game, right? So get to the finals game, get there a couple of hours early, like 45 minutes before tip-off, the locker room opens and anyone with a media pass just goes into the locker room and you can interview anybody. Like, the only people you can't talk to are the guys who are going to be on the podium at the end of the day. So generally that was LeBron and Steph.
Yep.
But besides that, you could walk up to anyone. You could walk up to Clay, you could walk up to Bogues, and you could just take up the whole time of them getting dressed, asking questions if you wanted to. So the very first locker room we walked into was the Cavs locker room, and we were going for a real Australian angle. So one of the first frames of footage that I shot was us putting a microphone in Dele's face as he's putting his finals jersey on for the first time, answering questions. Like, he literally got no shirt on, answering questions, putting on his top, and that just would never happen in Australia. Like, that's just not, the media is just not welcomed like that. But the NBA are very much like, the more coverage we get, the better. And I think the good thinking behind that is rather than putting one person up on a podium and we all ask the same questions and we all get the same answers and we all go away and write exactly the same story, right? Mm-hmm. Which is what happens here in the AFL or the NBL. In the NBA, 40 guys walk in a room and they all get 40 one-on-ones with 10 different players, and the NBA gets 10, 20, 30 different angles of the same game out there in the media, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
So one guy's angle, you know, might be the vet who's, you know, playing out his last final series and, you know, what he's trying to teach the young cats, and then another person's angle is, this is a young guy in his first final series, how nervous is he? Did he ever think he would get here? And there's all these different stories that come out of the same locker room at the same time. And I just think it's a better way of doing it. And I think all sports in Australia could learn from that.
Yeah, I totally concur. Have you kind of heard, like, Bill Simmons has been very down on the whole podium, and a lot of media, down on the whole podium thing, of just like, you know, how was the game? You know, the questions are very pedestrian.
Yeah.
He's often said, how can we change this? I mean, you've been there. Do you have any concrete ideas?
Nah, I mean, I haven't heard that criticism, but he's right. Not really. I mean, when we're talking finals, I don't know what happens in the regular season, but when we're talking finals, a lot of that media there are foreign people. A lot of them are foreign-speaking people. So, you know, if you have LeBron up on the podium, chances are, you know, someone from an Asian country is going to ask a question that's relevant to them in Australia. So they might ask a question like, I know for one time LeBron was on the podium and someone asked him a question about Yao Ming. Like, what does that have to do with the 2015 final series? I have no idea. But they have their angle. They have the reason why they're there. So it's kind of like, you know, you got to kind of let that happen. The NBA needs as much exposure as they can get. I don't know if you can fix it per se, because their time is valuable, you know. So I think journalists in general as well are very guarded for their, you know, deep questions. I don't think they want to ask those types of things that Bill's referring to. I don't think people want to ask them in a press conference because they don't want to give away their story. Do you know what I mean? They want to wait. That's it.
I mean, I was actually thinking, you were at that press conference where the guy stood up and said, like, oh, LeBron, seems like you're shrinking. But I just thought, no, that was when he was with Miami in the Dallas series. You remember that question?
No, I don't. No.
Oh, he got up. This guy got up and goes like, oh, you know, most star players, LeBron, in the finals can just step up and you're not stepping up. You're kind of shrinking from the limelight. Do you think that's the case? And LeBron basically says, you're not watching the game, you know, but obviously, you know, just on the thought of a reporter standing up and doing that, would you think like, oh, that? What would be your reaction to just a reporter gone rogue?
I don't know. I think everyone's there for everyone's trying to go viral in some way. You know what I mean? In this day and age, a lot of people are asking those things because they hope that it will turn into a soundbite that goes around the world. The year we were there was the year that an Aussie asked some question about Delhi to LeBron, and LeBron gave that great answer. He's like, I love Australian guys. You guys are cool. And like, that's, you know, and they knew exactly what they were doing. They knew they were going to get something like that out of him. And, you know, that's what you want, because that gets played all around the country and, you know, it works.
Yeah, neat. What was I about to say? But you can kind of see how players would kind of get bogged down, like, oh, here we go.
Yeah, that's something I was gonna say before. Like, you know, when you're talking about podiums and stuff, I think it's a fine balance, because while we don't want, you know, we don't want them on the podium, we want to get them one-on-one and have all these exclusives and have the angles that we don't want to give away. They only have so many hours in a day, and they don't really care about what we want, and they shouldn't. That's not what they're paid for. They're paid to win basketball games. So it's sort of, they've got to find that fine balance. I don't think there's a problem with putting your massively wanted guys on the podium, because, you know, someone like LeBron would just never get home after a game. You know, everyone would want their piece of him. So I get it. And I think they probably already do it to the best of their ability to help both sides of that.
Cool. Neat. My next question, have you got anything in the pipeline or an idea or even just something you'd like to do with Flicks?
Yeah, I've got a couple of ideas. I'd love to do an international version of Cardboard Addicts. That's the thing I'm trying to get off the ground at the moment, because obviously in Australia, the biggest sports cards here in Australia are footy, AFL cards and stuff like that. So the values are not anything compared to cards that are 100 plus years old in baseball and stuff over in America. So,
oh, yeah, of course. That's where it all starts, with the baseball stuff.
Yeah. And I already know... You know, I already know five or six guys that are keen to be in it that have collections worth more than $10 million. So, you know, that sort of stuff, getting that on film will be epic. That's sort of... This version was kind of a feeling out thing. Like, I know that trying to explain to people how I could make sports card collecting interesting to watch is almost impossible. So I sort of thought, well, let's make an Aussie version and I'll show you that it's possible. And then let's go for the big dogs over in America. So
I gotcha.
Fingers crossed, but you know, I'm trying to get that up. There's a 30 for 30 that I have in mind that I've spoken to ESPN about a couple of times that I'd love to make happen one day. But that's probably something, you know, 3, 4, 5 years down the track. Sure. But there's a cool story there that I want to tell.
Keep it secret. Don't give away your secret recipe.
Exactly.
With the Cardboard Addicts stuff, like, so just like from a production standpoint, so when you got that pitch, so when you did Cardboard Addicts, did you have a treatment you'd written, or you just kind of had a small sizzle reel of the idea? Or
yeah, normally you would pitch things through a PowerPoint presentation. So I made a PowerPoint presentation of this, but as soon as I looked at it, I was like, this looks so boring. Like, people who don't collect cards will not get this. They just won't trust that I can make sports cards exciting. And so I went away from the traditional pitch, and I made a 5-minute video where I just like interviewed like a sports card shop owner. Filmed some like sick cards that I knew of that were around the place from collectors that I knew, and I just made like a quick 5-minute thing to just show I can make this interesting, and sent that to ESPN, and within 24 hours we were talking about the production and how it was going to go. So, yeah.
And production and stuff, when you're sitting down, is that quite difficult working out, like, how much a Cardboard Addicts is going to, how much time it's going to take and how much it's going to cost? Like, is that something you learn at
Mac? Yeah. Yeah, and I always tend to underestimate it, that's for sure. these things take time, like, and I'm a perfectionist, and I don't like to rush. I don't like to rush things if I know that I can do them better. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's kind of like it's kind of like work out how long you think it'll take and then add 50% onto it, because that's probably what will happen.
Okay, yeah, no, that actually makes a lot of sense. And when you were saying with PowerPoint, so obviously with Cardboard Addicts, you were like, I got to make a sizzle reel or whatever you want to call it. But with PowerPoint stuff, what do you normally do? Like, what's a project you've pitched with that? And did you just do, like, a couple of frames? And what do you kind of explain in those PowerPoints?
It's sort of, yeah, it's pretty boring. It's a lot of text on the screen, like how, you know, styles in which that you want to shoot it, the narrative of the story, the topics that you're going to touch on, the age group that you're targeting, you know, what you're hoping it'll hit in terms of emotion and that sort of stuff. It's pretty boring which is why I went for the video instead.
I gotcha. So you, and in that, you're not really talking about, like, you know, oh, here's the idea, the emotion, da da da. And then you don't go, oh, we think it's going to take, you know, 6 months to make, and da, da. No, you actually just talk about the story.
You touch on that very briefly, maybe at the end, like, this is the rough budget, this is how long it'll take, this is where the money would go, that sort of stuff. But it's more about
story.
They more want to know what the closest thing it is to. So they love to hear, like, it's going to be like this.
Napoleon Dynamite.
You know. Yeah. Yeah. Like, I very much was like, so for Cardboard Addicts, my pitch was like, if you like the toys that made us on Netflix, you'll love this. Like, that was pretty much my pitch. Yeah. Yeah. So that's what they want to hear. They want to know what it's closest to that has been successful in the past.
I'm going to write that down. Closest it's been successful. Yeah, because I mean, I think it's a good idea. I think I like quirky stuff like that. But I will say, when I was walking through an old video store, and you see it, I used to hate that. It's like, it's Napoleon Dynamite meets Mean Girls, or something like that. You're like, how is it those two things?
It's not as bad as when they say from the makers of, and it's like the guy's so very loosely involved with this film.
Looking more widely now, like, you've got your visual style. Like, are there any directors, sports or otherwise, who you're like, that you like their visual style, or even shots from particular movies that you're like, oh, I'd love to do that in sports or something like that?
Well, I sort of take a bit from everyone, to be honest. So when it comes to, I'm story driven, and I think about the visuals second.
Okay.
But I put a lot of effort into the visuals when I get there, of how I can make it look unique.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have the story to start with, there's not a lot you can go with. So, yeah, I'm story driven. You want to get people's attention before you start thinking about the looks and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I take bits from everyone.
Yeah.
You know, I like to look at really, really high end productions that cost, you know, tens of millions of dollars to make, and then go, how could I do that for next to nothing? And I try to work out camera techniques of doing, you know, things like that. I know that I did a shot with Mitch Creek once that actually won a cinematography award for the whole story. But one of the shots was essentially, you know, the Matrix camera pans around. And I just had Mitch dribble up to me and then palm the ball, and then I ever so slowly walked around him, and then he crossed me over, and I just sped that up in post.
Bang, done.
And it looks like the Matrix, shot, but cost nothing. Yeah, but cost nothing to make. So I like doing that sort of stuff. I like looking at really high end stuff and going, oh, I could probably do that for nothing, and try to find ways of doing it.
Yeah, what sort of camera do you use?
So for Cardboard Addicts, I use an FS7, or I use PDW 800s, which is essentially what, like, you know, Channel 10 and, you know, like all your broadcast TV cameras use and that sort of stuff. And a myriad of different lenses depending on what you're shooting.
Because there is one nice shot in Cardboard Addicts, and because I was at a house that had ESPN. The one shot I like, where I was like, oh, that's the shot that I think, if you're selling it, really makes sense. Where you've got the low angle looking down at the card shop, and you've done a time lapse, or it's sped up, and this guy's gone.
That's a very simple shot. That's a GoPro locked off on the shelf.
Exactly.
That's all that was.
It makes sense to me, because people would be like, trading cards. Like, this is not. And then you see that shot, you're like, oh, shit, people do.
Yeah,
this gets a buzz.
Still popular.
Know?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's neat stuff. I like that shot. I think that for me kind of sums it up. But yeah, cheap stuff with the camera. Like, do you just toy around with cameras a lot? Like, did you have one growing up?
Yeah. So my brother he's a musician, and growing up, everyone used to say to him, you know, oh, you better have a backup. You better have a backup. No one can be a musician, and so on. And when I was hitting my formative years at maybe 13, 14 years old or whatever, and I was thinking about being a cameraman, but everyone around me was telling me the same things that they told him growing up, the same people were saying the same things to me. He one day just bought me a video camera and basically said, don't listen to anyone. If you want inspiration, talk to me, go around and just film to your heart's content. And yeah, pretty much had that everywhere I went for the next decade, just filming random stuff, pretty much. Made like stupid movies as kids and stuff like that. And
yeah, I know it.
Yeah.
What editing software do you use? You Adobe guy or Final Cut?
Yeah, I'm Premiere now. I was Final Cut for the last probably 15 years, but I've moved into Premiere as of late. I just find it a bit. I liked Final Cut Pro 7, which was directed more at professionals, but when they dumbed it down and went to Final Cut X, I just found it too basic and couldn't really do anything more than the basic sort of stuff. So I went back to Premiere, which had a very similar interface to the old Final Cut Pro 7, so it wasn't as much of a learning curve and could do all the little special effects that I needed and stuff like that, because a lot of cardboard addicts is, you know, I'm filming it in a studio in pitch black with just, you know, one coloured light on the wall and black sheets and stuff like that, so I need to be able to tweak a lot of stuff, and I just found Premiere was best suited for that.
Yeah, neat. Looking at the NBL this year, like you said, you have been sort of away from it a bit this year, but is that just because of work commitments or something else?
Yeah, it's a few things. I think like a lot of Sixers fans, I was kind of put off a lot with the way that they treated Mitch Creek in the last off season, to be honest. And while I'm good friends with Mitch, I'm not, you know, great friends with him, but it just, I don't know, it rubbed me the wrong way, and it took a lot for me to put time out of my day to watch them play this year.
Gotcha.
I'm not sure why, and I'm sure I'll come back to it. I have had periods as a Sixers fan where I've ducked away for a couple of years and I always come back, but no, this season I was just sort of off the radar. I always knew what was going on. I was still recording every single NBL game that got played. I always knew scorelines and I knew things went down to the buzzer and that sort of stuff, but I next to never watched an entire game until the grand final series this season.
Wow.
So,
Do you think things will be different next year? I mean, I'm happy to speak about Adelaide. I think they're all over the place, if I can tell you that. You know,
I don't know. Like,
in and out, and Mitch is gone, and, you know, guys, Sobey's left for whatever reason. It seems as though it's sort of a bit of a clash with things. You know, management's going one way, Joey's going the other, seemingly.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's going to totally correct itself in the next sort of before the season.
Yeah, without, you know, no longer having many contacts and stuff in the club, anything I've said would, you know, just be an opinion, really. But from the outside, it doesn't look good. I mean, I find it hard to find anyone who's speaking positively about the club at the moment. But, you know, we've doubted them before, and they often come through. I mean, at the moment, we have 6 players signed. I say players loosely. We have Daniel Johnson and stuff, and maybe some others. But
I think there's Froling.
Yeah, it's
Johnson, Ramon Moore, Wiley.
Well, I'm hoping Froling ends up with an NBA deal. To be fair, so hopefully not part of the team. But I can't really talk about it because I do all of his tapes for his American agent, so
no more.
I hope he does well. I hope he really, really, really does well. But yeah, I don't know what team they're going to put on the floor yet. But hey, I mean, I've written up the Sixers many times at the start of the year, thinking that the team on paper could not compete with other teams recruiting, and every year Joey always seems to get him there. So
fingers crossed.
I stopped doubting him from now on. I don't want to write him off anymore.
Sure. One last question, Lennon. You're looking at sort of what's going on with, like, now Casper Ware's jumped the team and Mello Trimble's kind of divorced himself from Cairns, a small, little, lovable team that now he's just, you know, gone away. What's your sort of feel for the storyline of next year? Like, if someone said to you, I want a long form piece on the NBL about this season's movements and a few things, what would you do?
Oh, I don't know. You're asking me to write something that hasn't happened yet.
That's true.
It would have to see how everything sort of evolves, but I think you would start it at, you know, those big moves, like you said.
Yeah.
You know, you'd create some drama behind Mello's first game against Cairns and Casper's first game against Melbourne, whether there's any bitterness there and who comes out on top and that sort of stuff. And I guess you'd get all the other teams talking about how big teams can buy championships and all of those sort of storylines, and then you'd follow through to the end of the season and probably say the Kings win the whole thing, but yeah. Who knows?
You know, sort of a David and Goliath, but this time Goliath kind of beats the heck out of David. Maybe, who knows? As you said, a story untold. Thanks very much.
I have nothing against the Kings winning a championship. I think, like, it can only be good for the NBL to have a success story in the city of Sydney. So I really hope that they do well, to be honest.
Perfect. Are you doing anything for the the FIB World Cup?
Not planned as of yet, but possibly. I'll know closer to the time.
Yeah, and anything, what about those Team USA games in Melbourne and Sydney and places? Nothing on those yet?
Yeah, well, hopefully if I do, it'll be for the NBA, because I do all the NBA, anything that the NBA that happens in Australia, I normally cover that for the NBA. They're one of my clients. So, if we can, I'm going to definitely be trying to think of some angles to catch up with some of those guys to write NBA-based stuff on those Team USA guys when they're here. But what that is, I don't know yet.
Don't know yet. Okay, well, good luck with that. What's that like when you get that tap on the shoulder from the NBA to be a client? That must be pretty special.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, it sort of was an extension of I'd met them when we were over doing the finals, and the following year I went over and covered the draft, and we spent a couple of days with Ben Simmons before he got drafted number one and stuff. So I dealt with a lot of these NBA executives that make those sort of decisions. So when I went out on my own, it was one of the first emails that I wrote, and I kind of didn't expect anything to come from it. It was kind of a thanks, no worries. Wow. Yeah, and I just said, hey, remember me, you know, we did this stuff in New York and at the finals, and if anything ever comes up, let me know. And it was just a, you know, generic, polite response. Thanks for letting us know, we'll let you know. But like a month later, you know, things were happening, and they were like, hey, you know, we need you to go to Melbourne and film this and go to Sydney and do this. And yeah, it was cool.
Do you see a bigger NBL America connection, like, growing forward?
Is that
the future of the NBL? I kind of think so.
You'd hope so. I mean, you know, the Kings guys are over there today as we speak, and hopefully making some valuable connections with guys at the Warriors and stuff. I think it's only a matter of time before an NBA game gets played here. And you know, I'd be interested to know if an NBA game could get more players than Australia versus USA, in theory, depending on the teams you bring out. So, you know, a 76ers versus Utah game, for instance, where you got four Aussies on the floor, would be sick.
Amazing. Yeah, absolutely amazing. Lennon, thanks very much for your time. I really appreciate it. I had a great time.
No worries, Joseph. Thank you. Thanks for having me. I hope it didn't bore you.
Not at all. And good luck with everything. Like, fingers crossed, I'd love to see some NBL long-form stuff. If anyone's listening, tap Lennon on the shoulder and get stuff made, because I'd watch it. And that's fun.
No, I'd be dying to, mate. I'd love to go back to the old days where we make the documentary at the end of every NBL season. Recap sort of thing would be awesome, but
fingers crossed.
Oh, well, we'll see. No worries, man.
Thanks very much. Good luck with everything, and thanks again.
Thanks, Joseph.
Bye.
All right, bye.
Thanks, everyone. Hope you enjoyed that episode. If you did, by all means, download, like, and subscribe on Apple or Spotify or Audioboom, wherever you're listening to this. I also have a YouTube channel. I post some stuff semi-regularly. Definitely check it out. And definitely check out Lennon's stuff at Flix Productions and his YouTube account. Thanks very much. Bye.